Well, good morning. Good morning. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Matt. And what I usually do when I introduce myself within this room is I say, good morning. My name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. And but that's later in the story. So my great grandfather, I got this ratty T-shirt on today because this was my grandfather's, and it's the 100th anniversary of the Salvation Army. And my great grandfather came to Christ in Holland. I don't remember the date, the time, whatever. But when he became a Christian, my great-great-grandfather, who was a saloon keeper, and they lived above the saloon, he chained them in the attic. And the Salvation Army bands would come around, and he would hear the open-air meetings through the vent of the attic and would worship and chained. And so my great-grandfather, he came to America and started a life, and that's you know, kind of been in my father's side since then. And just say that to sort of set the stage of, like, that is kind of what I was born into. And my grandfather on my mom's side was the national commander of the Salvation Army in the U.S. My father was a leader. He was a divisional commander over Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Florida. And I'll just say it's a very interesting subculture to grow up in. And I definitely don't want to paint any bad picture, because I had a really amazing upbringing. You know, my parents were committed to a life in service of Jesus within that calling. And from as early as I can remember, you know, I was serving coffee in veterans hospitals and soup kitchens and angel tree programs, giving out gifts to the homeless, and just really serving low people. And the founder of the Salvation Army, William Booth, one of his slogans was "Go for souls and go for the worst." And that's basically what was instilled within me from an early age. And, you know, I'm not gonna bore you with a lot of details, but I really kind of adopted that, and I fell into line, if you will. I was a good kid, and it afforded me a lot of opportunities to serve overseas, here in the States. I slept under the bridges with homeless friends of mine. I've sat in the owner's box with the Joneses at the Cowboys games, you know? So, like, a wide juxtaposition of experience that had nothing to do with me and everything to do with the service of my family. Well, I guess I was in my mid-20s when I had a mid-20s crisis, you know? And I was doing this way of life. And then I developed a relationship with a mistress of mine, and her name is Alcohol. And it didn't start and get out of control initially, but that sort of, as I was struggling with living up to this expectation of who my family was and these perceived expectations that were on my life, things got really out of balance within me. And I'll basically just leave it at that. I didn't feel enough. I didn't feel worthy. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, kind of veering this way, and like, I questioned my purpose, and I just was getting a little lost, you know? And just not feeling like I was making people proud. And of course, all of that was in my head. but my perception was my reality, you know. And so at some point, you know, over time, I set my moral compass on some concrete and smashed it with a sledgehammer, you know. And I didn't want anything to do with my family's name. And I wanted the past and the morals and the, you know, what my parents did to just kind of be erased from my existence, because I couldn't really handle, like, not feeling like I was enough, right? And and this, of course, is like, you know, over a lot of years of just kind of like dealing with this inner turmoil and kind of being this good person, but just being stuck and walking along the edge of this knife, you know, and always kind of going over this way, but always having this in the back of my head. And dealing with the way that I, you know, eventually began to deal with that struggle is, you know, I just kind of drank more and invited drugs into my life. And, you know, for who I was, it was just kind of, it was, even to me, it was just sort of bizarre of, you know, my first job was at a Salvation Army thrift store. And I worked with this guy, his name was Joe, and he spent a lot of years on Skid Row, and he shared a lot of his life with me. He was an adherent in the Adult Rehabilitation Center down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And was working off Hallandale Beach Boulevard and, you know, stealing horror books to take home and put on my shelves at home, and it's just a weird time. But, you know, he's, with what he shared with me, you know, and I was like, I'm never going to, you know, that's never going to be me. And fast forward, and it was me. And, you know, I kept it all inside, and like many people understand, like, just the path of isolation, with or without drugs and alcohol, you know, like, when we get uncomfortable, discontent with, when I get uncomfortable and discontent with myself, I just kind of pushed others away. And I began to have some very real, very intense social anxiety, you know, just a lot of paranoia. You know, my parents kind of realized that something's going on when we would be out at a restaurant and I would tell them to talk quieter because people were listening. And I felt like this target. And the truth of the matter is I was a target. I was a target of the devil. However you want to interpret that, whether it's evil, you know, like, something wanted to bring me down. And I knew it and I felt it. And I kept drinking and drugging, you know. And that was kind of my commitment. And some point along the way, down in, I was living in south of Dallas at this point, and I met my beautiful wife on a disc golf course. And, you know, I was finishing up a six pack and, you know, sitting in front of the pond, and her friend came back around the corner because I had passed him on the course, and I knew that she was coming to, like, you know, give me this girl's number. And I was like, yeah, let's see what happens. And she wound up moving to Atlanta with me, and after my nephew was born about 5 or so years ago, and I was able to hide who I was from her for years after we had met. And there was very intense, you know, volatile times. And I put her through a lot. But she stuck with me. And she really was committed to being a vehicle of grace in my life and loving me despite myself. And, you know, as time went on, like, you know, that was like God was in, the God within her was loving me, you know, when I couldn't love myself. And things got bad to the point where, you know, I had first come into the rooms, as they say, of Alcoholics Anonymous, and but I wasn't doing it for myself. I was doing it to appease my family and make people around me who love me feel better about me. And but I didn't really realize that until I picked up a 90-day chip. You know, 3 months sober, never been that sober that long after I started, and I decided to celebrate with none other than a drink. And that turned into another 3 years of going further down the rabbit hole and further disconnected from myself and who I was. And, you know, I was pushing God away all the while. And the isolation just got really bad, and you know, the self-hatred that I dealt with, and self-pity, and just a lot of dark, suffocating thoughts. And this brings me to the real God story of what I really want you to hear today. Because miracles were mentioned, and miracles are to come in my story. And January 1st, 2020, a wonderful year that we all remember. Oddly enough, my wife came in from the yard, or I was out working in the yard, and she opened the front door, and I don't remember what she said, but I thought she, like, cut herself with a knife. That's how intense this was. And I, like, come running up the steps, and she's, like, freaking out, and she told me that we were pregnant. Mm-hmm. She was pregnant. And I'm like, you know, okay, I'm glad you're not bleeding, you know. Just breathe, it's okay. But at the same time, you know, this is, you know, 2.5-3 years of, you know, her knowing what I was doing, and I just still wasn't in a good place, and so she was kind of freaked out, understandably. Well, the night before New Year's Eve, I was sitting around the table with my sisters and brother-in-law and Lauren and some other friends of ours, and we go around and just kind of say, it's not really resolutions, but what do we want to see kind of happen or change in the next year? And for me, it had nothing to do with alcohol, but I did say that I wanted to stop doing drugs in 2020. And that was all that my sisters needed to hear, for them to kind of relay this information and more to come on that. So a few more weeks roll by, and on the 19th of January, we're going to go over to a family counseling session at my sister's. And this is the first time that Lauren's, you know, being invited into that. And at the time, we were married like 7 months or so, and 6 months. And so I had been up all night drinking and drugging and cooking bacon over an open fire, you know, just the normal things that we do. And I open the door, and my two best friends are standing there, open the door. And it kind of like, I was like confused. And it took me a few seconds to realize what I was actually walking into, and that was my intervention. And a lot of people fight that. For me, I had known I needed help, but I saw myself as too poor to afford that, and I, you know, we just can't afford that, and that's not for me. And so I just kept willing myself through just the struggle. And so I didn't run. I walked in, and I was overcome by a sense of relief, and like I could breathe, you know, knowing that this was about to happen. And so they go around, they say all their love letters, and I'm just like, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's so nice. And but it was very surreal, and it was very beautiful. I don't want to make anything light of that. It was very powerful. And anyway, long story short, I eventually, after telling them six or seven times that like I was gonna, I'd go, but it would be 3 or 4 weeks after I finished this job, and they kept coming back. So I look over to the 6 foot six former MMA fighter in the corner who hadn't said a word, and he's the guy who's gonna be taking me no matter what. And I said, "Hey, Landon," I said, "you haven't said much." I was like, "What do you think? What do you think about all this? What should I do?" And he's like, I think it'd be smart for you to go. And I was like, okay, I'll go. And everybody laughed, and I went and packed my bags, and he took me to Florida, and for my, as I like to call it, my extended vacation, you know, where my wife is at home, pregnant, and I'm getting some help finally. And my grandmother passed away on the day that I was 30 days sober, and same handler came down and picked me up at 4:30 or 3:30 in the morning, and we flew back up here to Atlanta, and I got to put my chip on her chest in the casket, and it was really beautiful. Got to FaceTime with her. She saw me sober, but so I'll fast forward, you know, to, you know, I was down there for 5.5 months, and I came back and was in a program here. And our due date, oh, and by the way, January 20th, the day, my first day being sober, is my actual real birthday. So my sobriety date and my birthday are the same. So I woke up in detox and ate a, you know, styrofoam cup of vanilla ice cream with a wood spoon, and that's how I celebrated, you know. And I needed that experience. And I savored that cup of ice cream alone. And paid the price because I'm lactose intolerant. But our baby's due date was September 4th, and, you know, I'm just like kind of, you know, doing the thing. I'm taking care of Lauren and getting ready for this and building cribs and putting lights in and all the things. And I don't think I mentioned, but this is our first child, right, that we're getting ready to bring home. And so we were going to start at a birth center, and she wound up coming like 11 days later than we expected. And we wound up transferring because of some, not really complications, but it was recommended that we do that. And so we transferred to another place. And she was in labor for 46 hours once it all started. And after, and, you know, I'm squeamish, so they're like, get dad apple juice, he's about to pass out, you know, like, sit him down over here, fan him, you know. And but I wanted to be there, right? And and so our daughter, Ember Love, who's looking through the window right there, she came out, and it was not what I expected, because it looked like a dead baby that they put on my wife's chest. And the doctor, prior to her coming out, was like yelling at Lauren to push because your baby's life depends on it. And there was no complications up to this point. So I was just like really confused. And I'm like, somebody needs to spank the baby and get her crying, you know, and it didn't happen. And it went from about 5 people in the room to 15 people in the room trying to resuscitate her because she didn't have a heartbeat or breath for 8 minutes after she was delivered. And I'm 8 months sober, pacing in the corner like this is not how this was supposed to be, and dealing with all this stuff in my own head and going to the worst case scenarios. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, maybe more, but I had to leave. I had to get out of there. And as soon as I kind of got out of the hospital, it just kind of came into my head like I'm going to get a drink, you know. And at that time, I wasn't really connected with other people who could help me to through some of those hard times. And there was nothing between me and another drink, essentially. And, you know, I walked into that gas station. I was going to pick up something else, but I walked past the drug deal. I said, I'll see you guys when I come out. And I went into that gas station on Boulevard, and I looked down to the beer, and something just kind of overtook me, and I just kind of looked away, and I went up to the counter and got what I went to get, and it was just in my head, like, it's time for you to go back to your wife in the delivery room. And I just, I left, and I went back, and I didn't get drunk, which is what I intended to do. And so that's miracle number one, you know, or three or four, however you don't know. For those of you doing the math. And I went back up there, and it was very intense, and it was a traumatic birth, as some people, you know, in here I'm sure have experienced. And just a lot of questions, a lot of confusion, and I'll cut to the chase. So she's transferred to the NICU at Northside, and they do what they call a cooling baby thing, and they kept her at hypothermic temperatures for 3 days so to prevent any further brain damage, and they slowly, like, bring the temperature up. And 12 days into the NICU, the doctors could not find anything wrong with her. And the medical staff are literally using the term miracle. And we're just beside ourselves and, you know, just like couldn't believe it. And it was just very, very intense. And, you know, my mom, who's like a Facebook queen, you know, she's got people all over the world. You know, there's like a convent in Colorado of like nuns that are praying for our daughter, and just like all this support. And it was really remarkable. And, you know, growing up with the experience that I had, there was just kind of like this rift that had come between God and I, and that like made it almost impossible for me to like connect with God. And slowly but surely, you know, just some of these experiences made things very apparent that, like, you know, God's been here all the while, and his hand is in this situation, and his will is going to prevail no matter how much I want to worry, no matter how much I want to go to the worst case scenario in my head and just paint this picture of this is what's going to happen, you know. And and so we, you know, we brought her home, and it was just a wild ride. And you know, I guess, so that was September. April 1st was the first time that I was invited to, at the time we were meeting outside, but I came to my first meeting here. And I've basically been connected to Edgewood ever since. And somewhere, I guess it was around Christmas time, this real sweet kooky lady came into the meeting and said, hi, I'm Marquette. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm also one of the pastors here. And we got cookies for y'all. And they had an invitation to a Christmas service. And that was the beginning of, you know, my heart being softened to kind of come back through the doors of a church, really. And make myself part of a fellowship. You know, it's been wild. You know, I've been connected and taken steps in my own journey, in my own recovery, and crossed the thresholds of vulnerability and honesty, and just been daily taking steps away from those patterns and tendencies and habits of isolation and disconnection from, you know, myself, first of all, but then others and people who, you know, who care, because I didn't want anything to do with anybody that cared about me, you know, in some of those times in my life. And I think this is like kind of the point where was the last kind of thought that I had of what I wanted to share. So God, you know, just come in and share what the rest of you want to have be revealed. You know, I don't want to get talking into about theological stuff with the Trinity, but the fellowship of the Trinity, that's an example of the, you know, what the fellowship that we get to experience within the walls of a church family. It's very powerful, you know, and I just want to say how much I appreciate, and on behalf of my whole family, you know, just feeling comfortable and okay to come and sit in a metal chair here on a Sunday, you know, because I didn't want anything to do with God anymore. You know, I was over it. And I'm kind of reminded of the scene from Count of Monte Cristo when, you know, the guy's in prison, and the priest, you know, he's telling him that, like, he doesn't believe in God, you know, anymore. And the priest says, "Ah, but he believes in you." And you know, I have so much hope, and you know, it's like my openness and my willingness and my honesty have been able to bring me to a place where I'm a marred piece of clay that I've been put back on, you know, the potter's wheel, you know. And to want to be reshaped and shaped again is another miracle, you know. And I'm just grateful to have been asked to come and share, and I hope that I kind of was able to get out of the way a little bit and you could hear some of what God's done in my life. And I'll just close it out, you know, with what our sister read, you know, because this really kind of covers it all for my story from this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen.